Hello and welcome to the Oncology Podcast, an Australian oncology perspective. For more info and to sign up to our weekly newsletter, visit our website, oncologynews.com.au. Thanks for listening.
G'day, g'day, g'day. It's time for the Oncology Journal Club, episode 8. I wonder if we've got any listeners who've been with us from the beginning. Spread the word, because we're really trying to bring you interesting articles and analysis done differently. So today I'm joined by my two wonderful co-hosts, Hans Prennan.
Hi, Eva.
And Craig Underhill.
Hi, everybody. Guten Morgen, Hans.
Good morning, Craig.
He lives in Belgium, not in Germany.
Wasn't it Dutch, Hans?
No, it was standard German.
Oh, okay. How would you say it?
Guten Morgen.
That's what I said.
Don't practice that. Okay. So let's get on with the show. Today we've got some really interesting articles and a very unique interview on topic with an amazing interviewer and even more amazing interviewee. Quite special coming up. But first, for our main papers, it's my privilege to present two interesting papers this week. The first one was published in JNCI, entitled Employment Outcomes Amongst Cancer Survivors in the US, Implications for Cancer Care Delivery. This is something that we all know about, but try not to think about, perhaps because we don't have a lot of tools to help our patients. However, knowledge is power. So this was published in June, and the premise is that the national prevalence of employment changes after a cancer diagnosis, but yet we have relatively little information about this. And the NCI and other institutes have called for more research on this topic. In this paper, they looked at three survey years, 2010, 2016, and 17, from the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey and Experiences with Cancer. So these are nationwide surveys in the US, and they looked at data from around 1,500 cancer survivors. What they report is that employment changes were made by 41% of cancer survivors, representing over 3.5 million adults in the US. Now, of these, 75% took extended paid time off, and 46% made other changes that included switching to part-time work or a less demanding job. And let's face it, who hasn't on a bad day thought, I'm out of here? So cancer survivors who were younger, females, non-white or of multiple races or ethnicities, or less than 20 years since their last cancer treatment, were more likely to make employment changes. And the paper concludes that they likely underestimated the impact of cancer on employment. Unfortunately, they couldn't get data to the level of the effect of cancer stage or treatment modality, which would be interesting to see how those things affect employment. And also, they did not have enough of individual tumor types to fully explore whether that made a difference as well. However, this study does provide population-level data about the prevalence, the high prevalence of cancer-related employment changes, and suggests that this is a topic that we need to talk to our patients about. So if you think back about your recent consultations, we try and probably avoid the issue of what patients are doing about their work. It is something that survivorship clinics do focus on, but we need to increase the engagement in this area across the whole cancer treatment paradigm. So I'm going to ask you, Hans, what do you do in your practice? How often do you talk to patients, not people who are facing a limited lifespan where we do talk about finishing employment and superannuation? These are cancer survivors. Are they prepared for the impact on work and how they feel now about going to work.
I have to admit that this is the most difficult group because indeed the ones with metastatic disease, we often discuss, okay, whether they should continue their employment, and it depends whether they feel good with the idea of continuing to go to work. But in those that are cancer survivors, it's more something that comes up later. And then it's also not clear for me what's the best time point when they should go back to work or not.
So Eva, you mentioned that if you were younger, female, non-white, then you're more likely to have these employment changes. But isn't that true whether you're in cancer or non-cancer? Would that be a criticism of this paper? Was having cancer an independent factor, or really is this just emphasising that these populations do have issues in the employment market?
I think it's a good point. This paper only looked at cancer survivors, and you would want to know the trends in the general population. However, when you think about it, there shouldn't be a difference if everyone is a cancer survivor according to any particular demographic, if all things are otherwise equal. So it's a really important and interesting area, and good question, Craig. And on quite a different note, my next paper is from the Annals of Oncology, May 12th this year, entitled Extrachromosomal DNA, Relieving Hereditary Constraints, Accelerating Tumor Evolution, with the senior author being Charlie Swanton. And Craig, I don't expect you to understand this or have any questions, but I'll go slowly for you. So the concept of tumor evolution is one where cancer cells compete to survive in a diverse tumor microenvironment. And under Darwinian selection pressure, the cancer survives and the principles of variation and fitness heritability apply. Extrachromosomal DNA provides a newly recognized mechanism by which many cancer cells exploit to rapidly adapt to changes in the microenvironment. So extrachromosomal DNA, ecDNA, or sometimes called extrachromosomal circular DNA, eccDNA, are, as they sound, circular DNA structures found outside of the normal chromosome architecture. Now, they contain oncogenes and all the regulatory elements for oncogenes, and they were traditionally called extrachromosomal double minutes, or DMs. And they were described as this some 50 years ago or more, but really it's only recently that we're learning about their critical role in oncogene amplification and tumor evolution. Circular DNA formation is widespread in nature, and it's used by yeast, by bacteria to proliferate antibiotic resistance genes on plasmids. The herpes viruses rapidly amplify their genome through DNA circularization, and it's also underlies a lot of issues for agronomic crops and causes big problems for weed control due to this rapid ability to adapt. So it's not a surprise that this would be a significant mechanism that cancer cells use to exploit and survive and predominate. Now, what's different about ecDNA is that there are no centromeres. So remember, the centromeres are that central part that anchor the chromosome so that they divide evenly. ecDNA without centromeres undergoes unequal segregation during mitosis. So that leads to non-Mendelian inheritance and increased tumor heterogeneity, with daughter cells that can accumulate extreme copy numbers of genes. And the structures also contain favorable epigenetic modifications that fuel this positive selection. And you even have very small ecDNAs that can transcribe regulatory RNAs off the circular template, and that can lead to abnormalities in gene expression. Now, ecDNA used to be detected through cytogenetic methods, which are quite cumbersome, but there are now special methods for sequencing of circular DNA, and that's greatly expanded the field. the TCGA found that ecDNA was present in around 26% of all cancer samples, most commonly in glioblastoma, esophageal cancer, and squamous cell lung cancer. And on these ecDNAs, genes like EGFR, MYC, CCND1, CDK4, and MDM2 were the most commonly amplified oncogenes. So ecDNA is an important new field in understanding cancer, and I think we'll be hearing a lot more about it. In summary, it drives aggressive tumor behavior, is related to poorer survival outcomes, and provides mechanisms of acquiring drug resistance. One in four solid tumors have now been shown to have cells that have ecDNA structures. And so watch out for this. It's not esoteric. These will be important, potentially targetable, and shows how rapidly our knowledge is expanding and what a big task it is to really control cancer with all these different mechanisms that drive the superiority of the cell and the survival of the malignant phenotype. Now, Craig, did you have a question?
You sort of answered at the end, Eva. So initially I was thinking we might need to think of a new segment entitled hashtag WTF, why did you choose this paper? Because it did seem quite esoteric, but as you said, it's really a whole new field of potentially targetable mechanisms, potentially new treatments in the future. And, you know, when you think about it's really our knowledge of molecular biology and tumor immunology, etc., that has driven quite rapid improvements in care. So maybe this is a whole other field.
It's interesting because of the whole paper, there were only two brief paragraphs on clinical application, but certainly these are being used. I mentioned the example of weeds in agronomic crops. These are areas where we can learn from scientists in other fields where these circular DNAs have been targets of treatment or modification for some time. So who's next?
Eva, I think it's my turn. So you've given me this paper to discuss, which I think is a bit more practical. We did think it was maybe timely to do one COVID paper in the podcast. So this one's from Robilotti and her co-authors from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York. And it's entitled Determinants of COVID-19 Disease Severity in Patients with Cancer. And one of the reasons we picked this is it's a salutary warning that maybe the use of checkpoint inhibitors is not as safe as we thought for patients with cancer during the COVID pandemic. So this was published in April. At the time, there was about 180,000 cases of COVID-19 in New York State. And at Memorial Sloan Kettering, there was a total of 423 patients diagnosed with COVID. Remembering this is a big cancer center in New York. 40% of those patients were hospitalized, 20% had a severe respiratory illness, 9% ventilated, 12% died. So that case fatality rate was similar to what's been seen in China and Italy in earlier publications. But one of the concerns was an association observed between checkpoint inhibitors and COVID-19 outcomes, which I'll come back to. But what they did find was that being older than 65, being treated with checkpoint inhibitors were predictors for hospitalization, severe disease, whereas receipt of chemotherapy was not, and receipt of major surgery was not. So that's a bit at odds with previous papers. And overall, COVID-19 patients with cancer had substantial rates of hospitalization and severe outcomes. But as we said, one of the independent prognostic variables for these negative outcomes was the use of checkpoint inhibitors. That was independent in a multivariate analysis. So that is contrary to previous publications, but somewhat of a concern. And Eva, I was thinking when I was reading this paper this afternoon that maybe we'll go back to our paper published in the Journal of Oncology Practice and update it with a bit of a flag for people to still think about and warn patients receiving checkpoint inhibitors that they may be not as safe as we previously thought. And also, I'm not sure what's happening with the prospective databases in Australia, but if they're not collecting that information, I think it's something that they maybe need to focus on. And it does make some biological sense because of the overregulation of the immune system and the risk of pneumonitis that patients who contract or are exposed to coronavirus may then get a severe version. And so also in this paper, the paper in previous paper publication out of China talked about lung cancer and smoking being risk factors. And this that wasn't found in this paper, but the use of checkpoint inhibitors, which is probably more prevalent compared to in Italy and China in the New York population, was a strongly negative independent variable.
Yes, remember at the beginning, we thought it might go one of two ways. Either these patients receiving IO would be at much higher risk for the reasons you've just said, but then there was a contrary view that maybe they're a little bit protected because their immune system is revved up and they would somehow clear the virus quicker. So it's surprisingly low numbers, but I think the paper only reported over about a month early on in the height, or just as things were getting to the height in New York. So further data will be really important. And as you say, recording that in the Australian population, although I don't think we'll get a huge answer from our cancer population, thankfully, and everyone should be wearing masks around our cancer wards.
So of all the variables looked at in this paper, the use of IO was the strongest predictor of hospitalization, severe respiratory illness. So it was somewhat of a concern.
So let's ask Hans, because Belgium has the highest number of COVID deaths in the world.
That's a bit debatable, but we have a high death rate according to the population, indeed. We're still not sure what the reasons are. We also collecting a prospecting database on data on immune therapy within cancer patients, but there's no results yet from this database to say whether it's safe or not. But I must admit that I also thought that it could have some protective effect on COVID.
Yes, much more data to come, and still surprisingly slow. That data was collected, I think the cutoff was the middle of April, and still takes a while, even with all this rapid publication, possibly longer now thanks to Surgisphere and that little controversy. And I think it's over to you, Hans, for some really interesting analyses of some new papers out recently.
Yeah, so I selected one paper. It's a phase one study, and it was published in GCO in print in the 1st of July. It was online in March, but it discusses the effect of lifirafenib, also called BGB-283, and is actually a RAF dimer inhibitor. So it's an inhibitor of BRAF V600, but also wild type, ARAF, BRAF, CRAF. And it's not a specific RAF inhibitor. It also inhibits EGFR, PGFR, and also VGFR. So it's actually also something that inhibits other receptor tyrosine kinase. So not only selective. I will explain later why it's important, this kind of new drugs. What they found in the paper was that the MTD was 40 milligrams per day. It's not so important. But as DLT, they had thrombopenia, also hypertension. So this hypertension could be explained by the VEGF receptor inhibition effect and fatigue. So what were the results of the study? There was one patient with a melanoma, with a BRAF mutation, who had complete remission. Not a complete surprise, I would say. And then 8 patients with BRAF mutations had objective responses. And which were they? These 8, 5 had melanoma, 2 thyroid cancers, and 1 ovarian cancer. They all had the BRAF V600 mutation, so that's important. So they also tested KRAS mutant patients, and there they found a partial response in endometrial and lung cancer. And this you have to remember, they found 0 responses in patients with KRAS or NRAS mutant colon cancer. So it seems that this inhibitor has no effect in KRAS mutant colon cancer. So why is there actually a need for these RAF dimer inhibitors? The reason is because you all know that the first generation of RAF inhibitors, such as femurafenib, dabrafenib, encorafenib, they only target RAF monomers. They are ineffective against RAF dimers. And in the case of BRAF V600, we know that it signals as a monomer, so there it's active. But sometimes RAF dimers are an acquired resistant mechanism. So there is a place for this kind of inhibitors. Also, tumors with KRAS or NRAS mutations, not specifically colon, but also other tumor types, there BRAF also signals as a dimer. So it makes sense to use a RAF dimer inhibitor. The only disadvantage to me of this study is that it's difficult to know whether it's really blocking the RAF dimer that gives the effect, or that it's maybe just the fact that it has a receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor effect against EGFR, PGF receptor, or VGF receptor. So it's not clear whether it's the only RAF inhibition effect or a broader effect, as we see in a lot of these drugs. So I'm not 100% sure this drug will make it in the future, but I think it's interesting data.
Hans, how do you say the name again?
BGB-283.
And just tell me, was the first author from Belgium?
I think the first author was Australian. He's even from Melbourne, I guess. I don't remember the center where he worked in. No, I'm just joking. It's the Peter Mac Center.
What a shame you didn't do your sabbatical there, Hans, in a proper center. Where was it again that you went?
I went together with Eva Segalov in Monash.
Fantastic. And a shout out to our good mate, Jayesh. Well done. Lovely paper. And now our exclusive interview based on papers about rural cancer care. We have none other than the wonderful Craig Underhill as our interviewer. And who else could he interview as an expert on this topic? Wait and see.
Well, today we want to focus a little on regional oncology issues. Eva suggested this paper entitled Closing the Rural Cancer Care Gap, Three Institutional Approaches. And today this might sound a little bit random, but I'll be interviewing myself. So, okay, here we go. Hello, Craig, regional cancer expert. Thanks for coming on the Oncology Podcast. Shall we discuss this paper, Craig? Well, it's a report from ASCO, who held a summit in April 2019 called Closing the Rural Cancer Care Gap, which was the second event in its State of Cancer Care in America series. It was a summit focusing on some of the problems of rural cancer care delivery in rural US and talking about some of the disparities, and then focusing on the work of three institutions who were trying to address these challenges across diverse rural settings. So we want to compare and contrast it to what's going on in Australia today. Thanks, Craig. Oh, hello.
Craig, it's Sabe.
Sabe Severson, regional cancer guru and professor of oncology from Townsville. Fancy you calling me. What's going on, Sabe?
Ah, it's just nice and warm in Townsville, you know, when these Victorians are freezing. I was just chatting to Rob, you know, the guy from Orange, he's also freezing in cold, about something about regional oncology issue. And I thought, hang on, we can't have this conversation about regional oncology without Craig, because he is godfather of regional oncology.
You mean Rob Zielinski, medical oncologist in Orange and COSA regional oncology chair? Really? Can you patch him into the call?
Of course.
Hello, Rob.
G'day, Craig. How you going?
Great, Rob. Well, you guys wouldn't believe it. I'm just here recording an interview with myself for the Oncology Journal Club podcast.
Craig, I told you, I wasn't interested in doing that podcast. I wanted something a bit more punchy.
But I told you it's Norman Swan or nothing, Craig. I told you this fellow has high standards.
Hey, come on, guys. It'll be fun. Let's interview you.
Righto, Craig. Make it snappy then.
Okay. You saw the paper in JCO Oncology Practice on Closing the Rural Cancer Care Gap in the US.
Yeah, of course.
Well, I was just going to discuss some of the similarities or not to Australia. I noticed that in the US, for example, the non-metro population accounts for about 15% of the population, which is probably a bit lower than Australia, but they're half as likely to have access to medical oncologists, and there are issues with access to multidisciplinary teams, access to clinical trials. Sabe, how do you think that compares to Australia in 2020?
Yeah, I think it is an interesting take on rural. Looks like overall, we have the same issues. You know, we have the numbers might be bigger. You know, we might have one third or 20%, 20 to 30 rural. But obviously, you know, we are smaller than overall US. But I have a feeling that in Australia, through the Regional Cancer Center, the initiatives, we might have the density of medical oncologists better. I think we are going to be better than US. And also because we have good cancer networks, we probably have better access to multidisciplinary teams. But interesting thing is actually clinical trials, because I was seeing those three centers rating in the order of 25-30% rural access. So I have to look into it closer. So we might be doing less well in clinical trial as a country, but I think it might be a contextual difference. We might have to be careful about that number of clinical trial recruitment. But overall, I think we have similar issues, but different degree, I think.
And Rob, what were some of the solutions they suggested out of those three institutions?
Yeah, look, nothing concrete, sadly, and nothing really ready to take home and implement tomorrow. But it's a difficult area, it's a difficult subject. They looked at three sort of case studies, as you mentioned in your intro, of rural cancer centers in the US. And I guess one common suggested approach really was to focus on clinical trials and means and methods to democratize clinical trials. And yeah, this is a really salient point that we all three are very passionate about, and perhaps we can talk a little later on about teletrials in that space. I guess the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, you know, adopted patient navigators. I think that's a really interesting topic to sort of explore, because that's not a huge thing in rural Australia. And they look for local leaders, communities and existing programs and look to develop and strengthen those relationships and form these community-based coalitions. So I really liked that idea, because I think we all know that, you know, what works in metro or what works in one rural community won't necessarily translate into another. So I think that's a really powerful suggestion.
Yeah.
In Missouri, they looked at, they really focused on clinical trial participation, and what they did here, which was fascinating, which I'm not sure that would work in Australia, but they sent metro oncologists out to these counties to help the local oncology team to sort of, you know, discuss, educate and enhance clinical trial participation. So that was a sort of a fairly novel idea that hasn't sort of crossed my mind, and be interesting to see what you guys think about that. And one other idea they used, which was quite innovative, was the use of a rural mobile pharmacy van to get drug to the patient. So that was pretty good. I know in my district we use a mobile CT van to increase CT scanning. So that was pretty good. And they had 36% of patients, rural patients, were enrolled in their trials, which is quite high, as Sabe has already mentioned.
Yeah.
And then lastly, the New Mexicans, which are not the Melburnians that have moved up to New South Wales. So they've got big issues with travel and language. It's a very multicultural state in America. And they use this hub and spoke model to try and bring clinical trials again to the communities, the remote communities. What they did, which I think is a really good idea, and we're looking at that here, is centralizing the administrative roles of clinical trials and thereby sort of taking, I guess, that workload off the rural sites and empowering them to focus on the day-to-day activity. So I think that's a really good idea. Again, they use navigators to enhance relationships. And they use this thing called telemonitoring programs, where they try to, I think, connect rural oncologists and health professionals with sort of more experienced academic researchers. So that was kind of a novel idea. So a few ideas there.
So I think the pharmacy van was interesting. I assume they mean compounding the chemotherapy, which is perhaps where there's long distance involved, good idea, but we seem to have overcome that with using a couriers and proper cold chain. But the navigators, there was an emphasis on that. And as you know, in some jurisdictions in Australia, there's still a reticence for governments to fund that. But I think in the regional rural context, they're really key people in the team to try and coordinate some of the care and support the patients, and really worth the money to invest in those roles. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. We call it trial coordinators, maybe, you know, in Australian language, but I think the rural sites need to have people who can do that job. The volume might be an issue, but somehow if that is incorporated into the standard practice, they could have different models of navigation, but that needs to happen, I think.
Yeah, we've got care coordinators, but, you know, I think what the navigators in America are, they're a much less experienced and less costly person, so they can hire or employ more navigators. And I guess at the moment in Australia, we really see that as a nursing-only role, so maybe that needs, you know, thinking about.
Yeah.
And the nursing-only role, very It's actually very high level nursing, like nursing level 7. They're very more expensive than care coordinators.
Yeah. Some places have piloted using non-nursing roles in those navigator roles, but they need to be part of a team that includes a nurse who can lead and give the clinical input into that team. There wasn't so much an emphasis on telehealth, and maybe that's reflective of where the US is compared to Australia in this space. Or it could be just that this was written before COVID. So COVID obviously has been a big catalyst for a move into the telehealth space. And in fact, we're hoping to do a whole episode on that subject going forward.
So Craig, with the telehealth, the new Mexicans,
yes,
they actually use telehealth for more education.
Yep.
The ECHO, Project ECHO, is all about education, but they actually use it mainly for education and connecting the rural sites with larger centers and academics. But again, purely for education. And I think that's different from our models where we use telehealth in Australia for treatment. So I think it's a variation.
That's right. So we've probably focused more on using telehealth for the patient care. And this was an emphasis on using it for education, which I think is something that we haven't probably done as much of in Australia as we could. But I think now everyone's getting it post-COVID, that's a way to deliver the education.
But remember, we talked about the benefit of telehealth enabled service delivery. The education is actually incorporated into it because it's a case-based, real-life, on-the-job learning for the other side.
Yeah.
So I think that's the other benefit we probably have to push, is that the tele-supervision is actually part of the telemedicine service delivery.
Yeah. So I think my take home from this overall is, as you say, Tsabe, given we have pretty good networks developing in Australia between metro and regional and between regional and regional, and with our embracing of telehealth, that, you know, some of the things we've done has actually been quite innovative, and it's something that we probably should highlight more to our colleagues through publications, etc. When I was researching this segment and I looked at PubMed and Google Scholar and put in Regional Oncology Australia, I was actually surprised how many publications in this field in this year. So I think it shows that we've perhaps gone to another level in regional oncology. We were really just getting things set up 10 years ago. And now that people have been in the jobs, they're actually starting to publish some research. So that's going to segue into the next paper, which is from the same journal, the JCO Oncology Practice, published on the 1st of July. And congratulations to Belinda Sullivan and her colleagues in Loddon Mallee, which is just to our southwest, based in Bendigo. So it's a neighbour of my own region. So this was a paper entitled A Framework for Improving Governance and Quality of Rural Oncology Outreach Services. Being regional oncology experts, no doubt you guys have read this paper.
Yep, sure.
It's a good paper. So really, this is about a regional Victorian centre, a larger centre, Bendigo, and they have a couple of smaller centres as satellites. They were really describing an outreach model. It's nurse-led model, but normally visited by oncologists. So I would say this is a pre-telehealth era or pre-COVID era. But the good thing about that was they were articulating some governance for doing the right thing, I guess, in terms of relationship between rural sites and larger sites. One other thing is you will find that a lot of the time when people do outreach or telehealth, it's actually all done through goodwill and at clinician level. It's not done at the system level. So I think the beauty of this framework is that it's asking for an MOU between sites. So it actually takes the discussion at management and clinician level. And I think that will be important for sustainability and problem solving in terms of resources in the future. That's an important thing. I think MOU is better than contracts because, you know, once the contracts land in the lawyer's hands, it will take 2 years. So MOUs are pretty good. So I like that idea. But again, in terms of their model, outreach, yes, it is a feasible model. There are outreach services still happening around the country. But the problem with outreach is they are not every day and they are weekly, two weekly, but the patients get sick every day. So unless you have a telehealth component, the patient might still end up traveling to major centers in between visits, or they have to wait for the next visit. So there's some deficiencies with outreach models. But I think the other good thing about this particular outreach model, even though the oncologists travel, because it's a nurse-led service, the capabilities still grow in the rural sector. But the traditional outreach models, the oncologists travel, they don't leave any skill behind, they travel back. So I quite like this paper, and I'm glad that it's published.
Yeah, it's not just about the delivery of care, it's about the quality of the service, it's about the mutual benefits to the patients, to the staff, it's about upskilling, education links, all those aspects that are often ignored because the clinics have sort of evolved historically. So I think this kind of more robust model is something that people could explore in their own clinics, and not just in oncology, but outside of oncology as well. Rob, would you agree this sort of fills a bit of a need in the way we conduct our clinics?
Yeah, I think it does, but less so perhaps in the future, because, you know, what we're hoping for is more regional oncology specialists to be in the region rather than sort of traveling. So, but yeah, I think this is a clever approach, and like Sabe said, a neat and quicker one than sort of going down a contracting approach. So yeah.
And also the other thing I also found now in the telehealth era, as we have done with Mount Isa, you can actually, if you build the receiving site or the rural site with capabilities, you could provide a 24/7 service on telehealth rather than visiting and spending time on travel. So I think the oncologist might have to consider that too, especially say, for example, if for me or if our colleagues decided to travel for Mount Isa at least even once a month, they will be traveling 4 hours when they are doing so, 4 hours on travel, 2 hours in the airport, so 6 hours gone just on travel.
Yeah.
So now by doing on telehealth, we are happy to be on call 24/7.
So where do you think we're up to with solving issues of disparity in oncology in regional Australia?
So there's been obviously a lot of focus on resolving the access issues, Craig, and I think we've made lots of inroads there with radiation, Linex in multiple rural towns, PET scanners. I think surgical services are still rightly focused in metro centres for complex surgery, but for other surgeries we've sort of divulged that and divested that into the country. So I think we're making some good inroads into disparity, but there's work to be done. I think where we really need to focus on is the really remote parts of Australia. I think sort of the regional parts we're getting right with good investment, but really remote places, that's the next barrier.
Yeah. And what do you have any thoughts there on how we're going to do that? Because it's interesting, you're from New South Wales and there's still a lot of, you know, visiting clinics from Sydney going out to regional centres, whereas in our state, in Victoria, there's more the regional centres going out and visiting the smaller sites in their region. So it's like the regional sites have become the hubs.
I guess it's like you said, in New South Wales, we're sort of developing more of a regional centre approach by trying to replicate in many ways most of the services you can get in the metro centre. What we need to do more of, I think, is adopt some of the innovative ideas the Queenslanders have done with telechemotherapy, because I think ultimately patients prefer to stay as close as home as possible. I think we've got to be more flexible and adaptable to delivering that. So mobile CT scans, you know, mobile chemotherapy of using telechemotherapy. I think they're the kind of ideas and sort of solutions I think we should spend a bit more time on in New South Wales.
I'm glad, you know, we come a long way. But I think one of the striking thing, as Rob said, along the lines of mobile CTs, I think we focus mainly on treatment side of things. But there is actually still quite a lot of delays in diagnostic components, like, you know, colonoscopies, bronchoscopies. I think we probably have to look at that component and look at it as part of an optimal care pathway, access to optimal care pathway. But then in terms of oncology itself, and I think I may be biased, but the real opportunity is with the teletrial. If you make it as a national program, what it does is it's actually improve collaboration between metro and regional rural. And also because of the telehealth direct supervisions, there's training of workforce, and also there's more investment in trials coming to the rural sector by getting rural patients in the trials. So I think tele-trials and hopefully MRFF and state governments and Fed will keep funding. But the last thing I want to say is really the integration with primary care is, I think, is fundamental for managing the whole spectrum and the optimal care pathway. So when we have teletrials, hopefully, we have to incorporate the regional rural GPs into the mix.
Yeah, just one thought as Sabai was speaking there was, I think another really important element here is data and data collection and more real-time data. Like, it takes too long to work out how well we're doing or not doing. And I think there needs to be some serious investment in that space so we can really tell early on, are we hitting those optimal care pathways? It sounds really easy, but trust me, I've been trying to do that in lung cancer. It's challenging. So I think we need to invest a lot more in sort of databases, data networks. That would be my area of focus.
Yeah, I agree entirely. So I think some of the other issues maybe is around using the telehealth for trials, telehealth for training, telehealth for collaborations between metro and regional, rural. We've got the investment in the bricks and mortars, but I think there's a lot more investments needed to try and take things to the next level. And I think we could have some great outcomes in regional Australia if we're able to do that. So thanks to you both. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Thank you, guys. It's been fun.
Yeah. See you, guys.
Thanks, guys.
That was one of the best interviewers and the best interviewees I've ever heard. You should try and top that, Hans. Over to you now for short bites.
Thank you, Eva. So I selected this week actually four papers which I want to briefly discuss. The first one is from authors from the Vall d'Hebron University in Barcelona. It's published in Annals of Oncology. And it's data that the Fusobacterium, we know it's an important pathogenic gut bacterium and it's associated with colon cancer. But what they did is they looked in rectal cancer treated with neoadjuvant chemoradio and found that when this bacterium was there, that it was not associated with pathological complete remission. But when they were still positive after the treatment, that this was associated with high relapse rates. And they think it's potentially linked to suppression of the immune cytotoxicity. A second paper came from Korea, published in JAMA Surgery in June 2020. It's a very interesting study. It's called the Pegasus study. And they wanted to look at the efficacy of ursodeoxycholic acid for the prevention of gallstone formation after gastrectomy for gastric cancer. It was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study in more than 500 patients. And they found significant less gallstones in the group that was treated with ursodeoxycholic acid. So I think it's something we have to take in mind in our future patients. Furthermore, I looked in another paper. It's in the American Journal of Clinical Oncology, also published in June 2020. And they report that there was nearly a quarter of cancer patients using medical cannabis, according to a survey from one oncology practice in Michigan in the US. It was not surprising, but it was a surprise that only half of these patients that have discussed it with their oncologist. Of course, it's from one center in the US, so it also depends when you have access to cannabis or not. But the patients claimed it improved pain, appetite, and also decreased anxiety. And the most funny paper I found this week was in Annals of Surgical Oncology, actually already published in March 2020, but I just found it this week. And it was that wives are key persons that positively impact prognosis for male patients undergoing esophagectomy. So now, Eva, you have to listen very carefully. So it was a Japanese study. It looked at 500 patients who got esophagectomy for cancer. And when there was a wife present, so when they were married, then this was significantly associated with a better survival in male patients. The opposite is not true in their series. So if you have a female patient with a husband, has no effect.
Not surprising.
Not surprising, indeed. So, but before we prescribe marriage to our male patients, I think we need more studies why this effect was seen. Has it something to do with mental health, emotional well-being, or just the fact that they got fat so that they got good nutrition from the wife? So I think that's why it's a very interesting study. I think there should be more studies like this, Eva.
Sex. It was the sex, I think.
Eva, do you really think married people have sex?
All right. I think that's the subject of our next podcast. But for now, it's over to our final segment for the day. FDA update.
Well, Eva, we just had to throw this in. Instead of a PBS update this week, we've got the FDA update. We have approved a combination in HER2-positive breast cancer for, wait for it, pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and hyaluronidase. That's right, hyaluronidase-ZZXF. How do we say that?
I think it's a Dutch word, Hans.
I'm so glad I didn't have to pronounce that word. It's called ZZF.
And the trade name is even better. It's called Phesgo, P-H-E-S-G-O, a subcutaneous injection. So we look forward to learning a bit more about that. Everyone can click on the links. I know you think I say that a lot, but...
You say that a lot. Everyone knows to click on the links. Okay, winding up for our podcast, episode 8. Hope you've enjoyed it. Stay tuned. We have some fantastic podcasts coming up, keeping you up to date with the latest, greatest, weirdest, and most wonderful in oncology with the latest, greatest, weirdest, Craig Underhill and Hans Prennan signing off, Eva Segalov, and thanks to Rachel Babman, our producer. Bye for now.
Thanks, Rachel and Eva, and feine Dach, Hans.
Perfect pronunciation.
It means go f*** yourself.
Bye-bye, everyone.
You've been listening to The Oncology Podcast. If you enjoyed today's edition and would like to subscribe, head over to our website, oncologynews.com.au, and sign up to our newsletter. Thanks for listening.